Okay. Oh, the lights changed, so maybe it's a good sign.
Oh. So did that work?
Yeah, so far the transcription's not very good. I have a secretary if I can ask.
Perfect.
There you go. Hey, that works for us. All right, let us get started. Seeing it's it is 4:35, so I would like to call the working board meeting for the Ocker Recreation and Parks District to order. It is June 18th, 2025, and as I had mentioned, it's 4:35 p.m. We are meeting in the Element Event Center Ballroom at 5658 South Cougar Lane, Kearns, Utah. I want to welcome everyone. It's wonderful to have you here. As far as individuals present, we do have trustees Wade Wright, Dave Howick, and Jeff Monson, who are here. We also have members of the public and staff, and then also individuals will be presenting. Thank you so much for coming. We appreciate your time. First item on the agenda is any discussion or general discussion of future agenda items. Does anybody have anything that we want to note on that?
I think it would be beneficial for next working meeting to solidify the timing of the increase that we were talking about. We kind of had the presentations last month, had a general discussion, but I think it would be good to decide if we'll do it at budget time or what. Just finalize it.
I would like to put discussion the rec center next door.
The what?
The recreation center.
Oh, discussion in the rec center. Okay. And just to let you know, I did text her back, Laurie back, and I have not heard back from them. So a representative from the county. So.
Okay.
Okay, any other items?
Okay. Nothing.
Okay. Any committee reports or any updates on that?
I don't have anything on policy this time.
Nothing on my side.
Okay, nothing on my side. We'll move to number three, which is the presentation of the 2024 audit. And we'd like to welcome Rob here. He's our auditor, and we just really appreciate his help, and Danielle and the staff. You know, Chris, and I know that everybody gets involved when they're pulling information and things like that. So thank you so much for all your help. And I'd like to turn the time over to Danielle, if you would.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so I want to start with the change in that position because I feel like this is
best. Can I ask you a favor? Yeah. Put your chair up here, if you don't mind.
And up there. Okay, so it's page 60 of the packet.
You can put your chair if you want. Okay.
Yeah. Page 60 of the packet.
Packet's very good.
Basically, the profit and loss statement, so it gives the best indication of kind of the yearly snapshots. So this combines the governmental activities, which is the ownership of the OPAL, plus our business activities, which is the day-to-day activities of the Park Fitness Center. The change in the position, page 60.
The what one? 16?
60. 60 of the
audit. One more to your right.
Or right. 14 of the audit.
14 of the audit. Yes, thank you. That's the one that works for us. Okay, 14 of the audit. Okay.
All right. So our change in net position for the business type activity was a positive $949,173, which is fantastic. Combined with the depreciation from the OVAL, it changes our net position by a negative $530,417. That still is a very positive place for us to be. From an asset position, if you go to the previous page, this gives us our assets, liabilities, and net position. So still very strong. $10 million of the OVAL, $23 million from KOPFC for a total of $33 million, $677,532. That's for total assets. Did you guys have any questions about any of the...
Any highlights or surprises?
No surprises from me.
Okay. Let me get my little snapple lunch.
Okay.
So
there was a change in one of our, in some of the requirements. There was a new standard adopted called GASD 101, which changes the way that you have to report compensated absences. And this made us do a prior year adjustment of about $75,000, correct? So that is reflected in the footnotes and in the...
Tell me what that is. That means standard.
Compensated absences is the way that we record basically a liability for future use of sick time or... vacation time, that type of thing. So it's basically just a paper entry. It's no real effect on anything that we're doing procedure-wise.
And how is that different than the future liability?
It used to only be vacation time, and now it's sick time as well.
Sick time's been included, but they're coming down more. So it's not just, hey, if you retire, we don't have a lot of staffs here, a lot of people that retire. B.C. Cook was probably our latest, and you have another. And so you have two things and you're sick. You allow a sick leave conversion every year, and based on the data that Josh told us in HR, it looks like four people leave because we had a three, whatever, falls to that. I think we have 100% of your sick leave conversion. As far as your sick leave, what Danielle and I know is they're doing the analysis. Generally, most employees are accruing more in a given year than they are using. But the new CASB standard wants you to estimate, take out your crystal ball and say, how much of that are you going to pay out over the life of somebody who's burned it in the past? How much of that is going to be paid in the future? So that's for us. Like, well, are we using first in, first out? Are we using last in, first out? Which is kind of what we somewhat adopted and said, well, if we're earning more, or accruing more than we're actually paying out, do I really have a liability? Now, that's not said for all employees. So we've gone the conservative estimate for now. And provide stats going forward through HR of estimating 15% of the remaining sick balance. We've accrued that as a liability on your books to say, how are we going to adopt this new standard and have an impact? Whereas before, it didn't get as stringent. So it really impacts sick leave. Now, every agency that we audit, we do like 30-plus governmental audits, everybody does sick leave different. Some can do it to health insurance. When you retire, some pay it out when you retire, some have an annual payout that goes. So you have to analyze what you're going to do and or change your policies when it comes to sick leave. Vacation's clear cut and dry. Yeah. It's earned, somebody leaves, terminates, retires, you're going to pay it. You might have a back benefit, and we take those into consideration when we look at your policies and procedures. What is your policy procedure as a district, and then how does that come into play with the plan?
And just to remind me, as far as sick leave, if somebody retires, is there any payout? So we don't pay out any sick leave at all, even if they terminate or retire, correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's just whatever got COVID. That first before.
Okay. That's what I thought I remember.
Conversion, I don't think it's paid. If you terminate and you haven't used it, you lose it.
You lose your sick. Okay.
So like Steve before he left, used all of his time, and then he submitted his termination.
Okay. And this is another reason why maximums, you know, putting a max on kind of helps manage those, that liability, things like that. And I know we've talked about some of that and those type in the past. So something, you know, further discussions and stuff like that to manage it.
Yeah, from our standpoint, this is one of the estimates that we have to make. Ten and I looked at each other and said, well, what should we do? We say, well, there's your crystal ball that says how much is going to be used. Because that's what the new standard is asking. How much are you going to pay out? It's not just in the next 12 months. It's over the life of somebody working here. Well, we don't know what the history of somebody working here could be a year, could be 10 more years.
Yeah.
This is outside of this specific audit, and so we don't need to have any discussion on it, but we might later. Converted sick time, does it roll over year to year, or is it okay?
I know Josh has wanted us to maybe revisit the way that we do compensated absences. Yeah. So
we'll,
at some point we can have
that discussion. Very good. No, thank you. Thank you for the information.
Any other questions about the audit?
Come up here. Thank you for me, Carrie. Bring a check.
I got one.
Did you?
Bring a chair. Don't get comfortable, though. We're not going to be there that long, right, Dave?
7%.
Give us your take.
Okay, so really, she's presented part of the financial information. We have some reports that come in here. So, like we talked about last night over at Kearns Improvement District, there's three reports. There's one independent auditor's report that we give, and then there's two. They're not opinions, but they're reports. One on your compliance with governmental auditing standards, which basically says, how are you processing stuff when it comes to compliance? Do you have controls over your financial reporting and so forth? And then the final report is on the state compliance. So let me hit the first one, which is up front. I think it's pages 1 through 3 in your book on the audited financial statements. So in the audit report, this is the best opinion that I, as an independent auditor, page number one.
Number one. And if they happen to throw out the 47 one, it's on the corner here.
We put it on the side.
It's on the side, right?
Yeah.
Keep on going.
Okay. So on page number 1 through 3, this is our independent audit report for your organization and their financial statements. The best opinion I can give your organization, we don't feel there's any material misstatements within the financials. We have management has agreed to adjust anything that we found. During the audit, I think we had upwards of 13 or so journal entries and so forth that some corrections. The prior period adjustment has said, hey, can I ask you 101s out here? Mm-hmm. So this impacts your statements not only for on the beginning balance, but how does it impact it at the end? So we had to analyze that one for 2 years. So it's what we've referred to as an unmodified opinion, clean opinion. The second end report is towards the back of the book. Is that what, 52-ish?
47 is compliance.
So page 47 on compliance. We look at this one from a standpoint is, do you have policies and procedures? Do you have controls that are set up within the organizations? Are you complying with federal grants, state grants, or any other regulations that you have to do? A lot of those for governmental entries here in the state of Utah is done by the state auditor's office. They put together a state compliance guide. But for this report, we don't have any material weaknesses or significant deficiencies that we feel we need to report to the board. There is some general recommendations that we provided management, such as journal entries. When Danielle does a journal entry, make sure another set of eyes is looking at that journal entry, much like when you have approval. Somebody's not ordering, approving the vendor invoice, and then paying the vendor invoice, and nobody else looks at it. Same with bank reconciliations. If somebody does it, you probably ought to have another set of eyes. So it's looking at your internal controls. Now, part of that, when you come to the state compliance side, you have your fraud risk assessment. So that fraud risk assessment that she presents to you as a board each and every year is really designed for you to look at the internal control structure here at the entity. It's like, is there any changes that we need to be made, especially as technology and other things continue to change and AI becomes more prevalent? Well, are we staying on top of what we need to do? Now, looking and say, well, can we separate every chair? Well, it doesn't make – sometimes you got to look at it from a cost-benefit standpoint. Sometimes the cost is still outweigh the putting something in place for the benefit because it would cost the organization more. So that's something that you should look at. The very last report, which is I think the last 2 or 3 pages, is on the state auditor's compliance. Now there's 2 sections to that report. There's one section where they require us to review things every single year, such as your budgetary adoption. Your fund balance. Now, you don't have a fund balance limitation that you do if you have like a regular governmental fund. in a city or a county where they operate a general fund. You don't. Yours is your proprietary fund. And then this building over here, the Oval that you own, we've treated it as a governmental activity, but it's just an asset and depreciation expense each year. You don't have operational costs because that lease agreement is with the Oval. They run it and leasing the building and space from you. So in this one, we go through those stuff annually. There's also stuff that we test every 3 years. That could be cash management, board member training. It could be your public treasurer. Insurance that you have, I think Kevin or Danielle, I can't remember if it's Kevin or Danielle that's designated, but the insurance has that picked up in case something goes wrong. Are you covered on a separate policy for stuff like that? You're posting your minutes on your enrollment in Utah retirement systems. I know Chris is heavily involved. Actually, Josh is probably now more involved with that along with Chris and doing the stuff. So we take a look at those stuff. Happy to, I think, report. I don't think we had any findings for you. Everything was done in accordance with the way that it's supposed to be. Like I said, we had a few verbal comments and recommendations that we made to Danielle and Kevin for them to take a look at, but nothing significant for you to be, that we needed to put in writing for you as a board as a significant deficiency or material weakness. So great job by the organization, really.
Very good. And I know it's been a learning experience for you, and thank you for all your efforts and for everybody. So thank you. Any other questions from the board?
Well, of course. you have to look forward 12 months, right? Anticipated something or other.
Yep.
Let me give you two scenarios. Okay. We had a grant come in for helping on the bubble. I can't remember the amount. It's unlikely we're going to realize that this year. So, Kevin, does that carry over to next year?
We have a period of time. It's tracked on EGRCC with the county.
And how much is that grant?
Here's $300,000.
$300,000? Okay. Do we need to do anything with these, or are we okay?
You're okay.
It's a reimbursement grant.
What's that?
It's a reimbursement. So once we spend the money, then we get some money.
And the other one is we're going to have a reduction in property taxes of about $250,000 that we will see later this year, right?
No. Yeah, it's going to take some time.
2026.
Yeah, next year's budget.
But we don't know that for sure because it depends on the property value and what our tax rate is. Preliminary looking at it.
So, I mean, 150, 300, somewhere.
Yeah, we won't know. We won't know for sure.
But we know for sure it's going down. We just don't know how much.
But there's also enough other growth in the rest of the district.
But the question is, do we have to do anything in the audit regarding that? If no. We know what's coming in the next 12 months.
You could put in a subsequent event footnote, but if you can't really quantify it, and it's really only 200 or maybe 200 to 250, 300, whatever $1,000, when you're staring at your fund balance is more than 10 million, it's just not a material event.
Okay.
Yeah, it could be significant for budgeting going forward, but because it hasn't really come to pass, it may not impact you for another, if it's 2026. No, statements are focusing on, well, hey, are we going to have a significant impact to 2025 with either some litigation issue that's gone on, we've lost half our revenue. Those are the stuff that we would put in as a subsequent event. Losing out on a potential grant and whatnot, you'll just fix that through what you budget and spend.
Okay. Very good.
Okay. Remember prior year, I am really easy to compare.
You just answered all the questions last year.
Are our weight room cultures any kind of contractors or they on?
They're on payroll.
What?
They're on payroll.
Okay.
you have any budget or, you know, budget audit questions?
How do we perform? You told me this, and I've never understood. How do we perform the audit on this building?
That is just, it's a condo agreement. So you have a percentage portion that you own in the K-Tech building. The Oval has a percentage that they own in the K-Tech building. You just read this. This reminds me.
City has, the county has 10%. Yeah.
And the county owns part of that as a TIC arrangement. So yeah. It's not
as a one arrangement.
It's not as a tenant in common. Mm-hmm. It's called a TIC. So as a tenant in common arrangement, each entity owns their percentage, dividing up the full piece of the pie, and then you share expenses. I know for this year, we had to make an estimate in the Oval's expenses because they haven't provided that to you yet. You pay for costs and then send them, here's your portion of the bill. Well, they do the same thing, and I think those are taken care of every 6 months. And that we did make an estimate for the end of the year because the Oval still hasn't provided. Have they provided that yet?
No.
So we made an estimate based on last year's and probably rounding it up just a little bit to have at least something on the books. But there is for this, when you say building, the building's owned by you, the Oval, and the county.
Yeah.
So there is no audit for the building.
Well,
all on your respective portion.
Building's wrong word. Operations building, whatever we... I just want to make sure we're getting covered on this, and it sounds like it's built into our budget.
It is.
Okay. I just lost my page. Sorry. Do we are expendable for PAC?
They're part of your budget.
Okay. Nothing special there.
They have cash, and we restrict that cash on the collections, and I think the payables are just done by Chris.
There's no activity. There's
yeah, it's out, I think, like $3,113, if I remember right.
That's the amount of cash we have on hand, yeah. But it's been interest that we've received, and that's it. I think about two more as well.
You know what? I think I am. Done.
Very good. Okay.
What extra comments would you add? Just in general.
In general, I mean, we audit a lot of governmental entities. So we've talked about best practices such as the journal entry review, and that's really designed to assist her. Yeah, she's got the expertise and. And making those adjustments, but I mean, Jeff might remember this way back in the day. You have controllers here, and because journal entries weren't being reviewed, we 400,000 got misplaced somewhere. Well, it's not that it potentially we didn't know was it stolen, was it not? It was just journal entered out into another account. So if we're not monitoring accounts, or you guys aren't going through your budget to actual every single month, you're going to notice stuff from a high level. But like Chris and Kevin can assist Danielle in making sure stuff seems to be reasonable. So when you look at the financials, it's not only looking at your budget to actual, it's looking at your balance sheet and say, wait a minute, why are our payables through the roof? What are we doing? You might have some projects or something coming up. We've talked about this over the last several years. You've got an aging facility. Well, an aging facility, we're either going to create a new capital asset or we're repairing a lot of our capital assets just to keep them functioning and so forth. So our expenses could be increasing because of repair and maintenance, but that's going to vary per year, but I think Brad does a great job in trying to maintain a lot of that type of stuff.
So okay. Who's going to be our second set of eyes on journal entries?
Yeah, when I have a significant journal entry, I talk them through with Kevin anyway. But it's just going to be a signature, so make sure we have that documentation.
As long as we're documenting it, I'm happy.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good Rob, thank you. Appreciate you. Appreciate all your help and things like that.
We're early this month, so I really like it.
And again, I just can't say enough. Thank you for all your efforts. I know that this financial audit is pretty in-depth and a lot of pulling paperwork and then refiling and things like that. But thank you, Rob. Your company does a good job. We always appreciate you guys and the thoroughness.
So going forward, if we wanted to change some accounting policies, could we run those by you?
Yeah.
Okay. Very good. So we are completed with the 2024 audit. We'll be discussing that a little later. And now we'd like to have a presentation by McKinstry. And so we just have Josh and Michael, if you... Jason. Thank you, Jason.
Good work, Chair.
We're ready, buddy.
Yeah.
Rob, thanks.
Thank you. Have a good afternoon.
No, it's mandatory to stay for the whole meeting.
You know, we're paying by the minute.
Yeah, no. Corey, go ahead. Take the afternoon off. You know, go ahead and have that afternoon off.
There you go.
Good for you. Good for you.
Thank you. That's what got it. We're done early. We've got to have to schedule girls'
camp. And there's on the legal
page. Say something.
This is right at the beginning, right after the first page.
Right after the agenda.
Right there.
I kind of like Netflix.
No, what do you guys want to watch? Well, thank you guys.
Can we just turn it a little bit so that the audience can
maybe just flat against that wall.
Slide it back a little. And
there we go.
That way, because we'd like everyone to be able to see the presentation. So.
Did you all?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, we're good.
Over there.
That's perfect. So.
Or just bring your chairs up.
It's a little fireside chat, guys.
Yep.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate you guys' time. Giving us the space to come here. My name is Jason Grooms. I am an engineer by trade, but I do business development for McKinstry. My family are located just in our Salt Lake City office just outside of Bryan, Canyon. I'm right by that Walmart in Utah, about 80. Michael, introduce yourself.
Yeah, Michael Reynolds. I'm an engineer, and I manage the development of McKinstry projects here in Utah, throughout the state.
What's your last name, Michael?
Reynolds. Like the aluminum foil. Yeah, I'm a graduate from the University of Utah. I live about 5 miles that way. I'm a member of the business center here, so.
Got to add that one.
Awesome. Very good.
So, yeah.
It's personal.
It's personal.
It's personal.
So,
we have a membership requirement.
You're in a contract.
No.
So, McKinstry.
I'm out because I don't have a membership. Mine expired.
We're a national design build company and operational reactions. This is timely based off of where I think it was Rob left it up, aging facilities and rising operational expenses. This is kind of the time to segue, so I appreciate that from him. We're a long-term company that's been around since 1960, privately held, so we have no public stocks and no Wall Street influence, which is quite nice. Pretty small company still, about 3,000 people nationwide, and our Salt Lake City office has been around for the past 15 years now. We mainly work in what we call high-performance buildings. So these are very complex mechanical buildings that deal with shifting occupancy, critical processes, people like defense. So K-12 school districts, higher education, rec centers, and cities and towns and counties, that type of work. So I mentioned our core kind of purpose as a company is to increase these two things. Operability of the facilities, reliability, so you don't have unpredictability, you don't have down days here. And then an overall improvement to that community experience. How we address these with our clients is by looking at capital needs, looking at OPEX over time, operational expenditures, and looking at the big fancy thing that is deferred data payment. Most of our clients are all public entities, all taxpayer funded, which typically means that funds aren't exactly where we always want them to be. And we look at accomplishing what we can within that budget that you guys have through creative mechanism that we'll talk about here in a second. So the secret sauce to all this is how we can do all that with a very limited capital budget and very limited staff resources. Because just having Kevin, Danielle, Kurt is probably, in an ideal scenario, you want three times of what you have, right? Like any organization would. So this all can be done through a way that is entirely state-free, state contract out there for it. It's an entirely turnkey process. So we handle the entire process with us. And everything that we do has a guaranteed outcome associated with it. So it's not a promise to say, hey, you know, trust us, it's going to be great. We are financially beholden to the outcomes that we guarantee at the project start, which is how this whole thing kind of sets off. More on that in a second here. So essentially, the funding mechanism that enables us to design and build and implement these facility improvements to reduce that deferred maintenance, to increase reliability and operability, is based off of what you guys pay to all these entities on the right. What you pay every month to Rock Mountain Power, to Enbridge, formerly known as Dominion, to the Kearns Improvement District, to Summit Energy, to all your chemicals providers and everybody down the line. You guys pay quite a bit of money every year to these companies just to operate your bowl. What we do is reduce that OPEX burden paid out to those companies. We keep the same appropriation of budget that you guys have to pay these guys throughout the year, and we redirect what's remaining to the facility upgrades. So essentially, your budget, your top-line budget is not changing. You're paying the same amount before and after because you have the same appropriated budget, but we're using a chunk of that budget to implement upgrades that reduce what you owe these guys. So it'll become more clear, I think, with this illustration. If I can stand up here, this is kind of the current state for you guys. You have a certain amount of office expense. We'll go into it in a minute, but you guys should be somewhere $500,000 to like $800,000 a year that you're paying to these utility partners. What we do is come in and identify that area of savings opportunities. Typically, that's between like 10 and 30% compared to the project and facility, everything else. But it's a pretty sizable chunk. We then package that guaranteed operational savings over a certain term, either 5, 10, 15, 20 years. Utah state code limits these to 20-year terms. So there's state governance over this type of process. But we can package that to 5, 10, 15, 20 years. You'll use that package funding to pay for the project right now. So essentially snowball the annual savings to get the project that first of all reaches that savings, but second of all accomplishes what we actually want to do of reducing that operational expense, reducing the downtime, reducing the risk in our teams. And after that term, that's when the utility appropriation shifts down and you guys end up paying less than what you did start. So essentially you're paying this money anyway. Why not get something out of it in the short term and then give yourself some money after that game? How you leverage that is oftentimes through something called a tax exempt means purchase. You're not financial advisors. This is one way that you can do it. There's many ways to do it. This is just a very common way within this model. So a tax exempt lease purchase is essentially the financing mechanism that can bundle those annual savings and package it all into one capital project right now. So these things, importantly, no upfront cost to the agency unless you want to buy down the interest rate, buy down the loan, whatever. The guaranteed OPEX in the equipment that is installed as part of the project serve as the collateral. So that's why the bank is interested in funding it.
From the bank's perspective, these are tax-free interest, so they're pretty excited about fund-based things. It's slightly above the interest of general obligation bonds, typically, and much less than what we would consider private financing. Like I said, at the end of the term, all the additional savings are capped in your bucket. Little to no effect on bond rating. So if you guys plan to bond in the next few years or longer term out, this does not affect typically that bond rating account or your capacity to take off new debt at the state level.
In your experience, what is little? I understand the no effect, but what is a little to no? What is little? Is it 1%? Is it 2%? Is it 5%? What is little compared to?
$1.50.
Yeah, $1.50. Yeah.
This is essentially a hedge. I can't speak towards that because I'm not a financial advisor. Our financial advisors that we typically partner with are telling us that it's negligible, but I can't give you a dollar figure or a percentage based off of what I can say.
Okay.
So,
fair.
Probably depends on
the agency. Oh, I'm sure it depends on a lot of different things, I would imagine. But
you have a typical real life experience with somebody else.
Yeah, Ben. Down Salt Lake City School District, they have done small for $40 million now of upgrades.
Close to 35. This, a lender like a Bank of America or a Zions Bank usually looks at this type of lending as, so they're willing to lend in this advantageous way because McKinsey is providing a guarantee that savings through the energy will cover the annual lease payment. So there's this three-way stool between a lender providing financing, you guys paying the lease purchase, but the case is guaranteeing the savings that allow that lease purchase payment.
So we, our contract is, if we come in and we, at the end of every project, we have an energy savings guarantee, so we guarantee the financial perform on the cash flow that AIC sees in these projects. And if that, at the end of that project, it's verified that, hey, we're short, we have a shortfall on that, and we can't literally write the check so that you guys can come back and pay the bank. So the bank looks at our financial guarantee as part of the collateral going into this as well. That's a security.
And where do you make your money from?
On the construction. So we act as the GCs for the installation. So we're just a general contractor at the end of the day. We have nothing to do with the financing. We just enable it. That makes sense. And the contracting methodology.
But then you go ahead and get another contractor to actually do the work, correct?
So we have all of our construction managers and site superintendents and all of
on
our
staff.
Engineers on staff. They sit 20 minutes from here, 15 minutes from here. And so they're on staff, but oftentimes we deal with very complicated scopes of work and in very different disciplines. So what we do with cool aquatic scope, what we do in chemical scope, what we do in controls, lighting, HVAC. So oftentimes we're dealing with 10 to 15 different contractors, but we act as that single point of accountability for each one of those contractors, and we have an on-site presence that is some salary and kitchen during the whole thing. So it's a way to accomplish very complicated scopes of work all at one time, all along in this way. And for the record, this does not have to be financed. A lot of our clients go through the process, and then they look, well, we actually have the cash on hand. Let's do this as an investment. Maybe it has an internal rate of return of like 6% over 15 years with the cash on it. Or, hey, we're totally draining off budget. We need these facility upgrades. Let's finance it. So it doesn't have to be financed, but it is just an option to leverage that on.
So we have a staff that is really good and searching cost reduction, all those types of options. Have you ever come across a situation where somebody has used it, they've already tapped into all of those options, or do you usually always find something?
I would say we always find something because you guys are keeping things running really well, but we're really kind of professionals at identifying energy savings opportunities. So we'll look at things like boiler hot water resets and chiller hot water resets, at demand control ventilation in your gyms, at energy efficient LED lighting with networked mesh lighting controls so that they can be occupants. They can be turned on like occupancy sensors. We'll look at things like putting pool covers on your pools to save evaporation and chemical loss. There's a lot of things that you guys would do if they had time.
That is the problem. So, and I don't want to be prepared, but every single organization you come into is a time.
We've had nothing all the time. Well, you're all great. He's really good.
We have worked with unbelievably good facilities managers. They live and breathe the facility. They're there after hours overtime every day, and they are super passionate about it. But they are dealing with 1,000 billion different things every single day. This is our entire job, and we are full-time staff, and there is, between 5, 6, 10, 15 people working on this. So it's a different product at the end of the day. And where we try to not step on your toes is there's three or four key touch points with staff. And typically, there's many, many more facilities managers. Typically, there's more with the recreation supervisors, the maintenance hands, whoever you have, because that is the lifeblood of the facility. And what they have seen in that history that they bring to it informs how we approach certain things.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
I have one more question.
Please, go ahead.
This has been a point for me forever.
Yeah.
Right? And that's HVAC capacity versus building corrosion. Have you ever come up with this mind?
I've noticed in a mandatory environment.
So tell me how you approach that, because it's just impossible.
So there are optimal conditions to maintain a pool, like an indoor auditorium. You're going to want to maintain it at 60% relative humidity, and you're going to want to keep the temperature 2 degrees above the pool water temperature. And you're going to want to have an...
Tell me why you do that.
So that's to minimize the amount of evaporation off of the surface of the pool. So evaporation is driven by the difference in entropy between the saturated air at the surface of the pool and the air in the bulk of the natatorium environment.
Now we're here to now.
So you know what? This is exactly the kind of stuff I like, because most people have no idea when you mention that, and he's already done it. He's been there.
So you're making engineers come back a little higher on his opinion than this. Because he mad mouth engineers. I just need to say that right up front. So. So you're doing good. Keep going. That's good.
Please keep going.
My standard tradition is I don't care what they spend, double it.
You have a professional saying that's not the best way to do it.
Most of them don't even know how to report that, so they always use it.
And most traditional engineers do at that point. They never want to call, right? So they're going to over-design the heck out of everything they do because they don't want that callback.
So the engineer that designs a building is going to look at the extreme day. They're going to look at the hottest hour of the summer and the coldest hour of the winter and say, my building has to have this much capacity for that day, and then I'm going to round up to the next size up, or I'm going to add 10% to make sure I'm safe. And that's oftentimes puts equipment into a point on an operating curve that's not optimal.
That's exactly right.
And then you're paying twice as much for it, too.
Yeah.
So, and the cost and operating efficiency of that is terrible, but the engineer never gets called. But that's not how we
are. And you pay extra for bigger equipment that's deliberately sized to be oversized. So we come into a design of HVAC equipment looking at the 8758 hours of the year that are in design conditions.
Tell me that again.
8758. There are 8,760 hours in a year.
Oh, gotcha.
When you design for HVAC, you take the hottest and the coldest. But the others, that's where you want to optimize your performance.
Thank you.
Yeah. Moving on here, just a quick note on the state contract. It was run by a veteran selection by the state. We scored the highest in technical qualifications. We have a very strong engineering top, but we then look at all the right amount of regions. We've been in Utah a long time, so we stay here a long time. And I mentioned before, but the state of Utah, there's legislative requirements for this kind of contracting. We are beholden to those requirements, so there is that third party factor. It's not a snake oil. Talking about you guys specifically, there's two things I want to go to, and then we'll kind of wrap up. First is just the cost impact that we're estimating right now. Secondly is the actual scope of work that we might implement. And we'll talk more about that in a second. But from a probable cost scenario, we actually are doing this process with one of your sister facilities. There's somewhere around $679,000 a year. You guys are roughly the same size. We're anticipating somewhere between $500, $700, $800 a year in utility costs. Probably not pretty chemical. Like I said before, we look at 10 to 30% reduction on that office. So that's, we'll call it $100,000 annually. For the sake of just having an example, that's between $1 million and $3 million worth of facility projects that you can leverage right now based off of that.
And that depends on the length of the term you're willing to accept.
So
$1 million if you want it in 10 years, $1.5 if you want it in 10.
And during the process, we run those scenarios with you guys and your financial advisor to see what works best for you and what should target.
So what do you see people doing typically? Life?
For what? For length. It's
like,
typically 10 to 18 is very common. 20 happens, less than 10 is typically unrealistic. That's more like a private industrial setting when we're dealing with process related stuff.
Public customers are usually confident that their buildings will be in use 15, 20, 50 years in the future.
So, so it's,
if you're planning to tear down and rebuild before we get too far. But those longer terms, let's us do more to help you now. I would say public entities are usually pretty comfortable at 15. Sometimes if they really need immediate help, they'll push at 18.
And state legislation also, the average sum of the lifespan of the equipment that we install has to be longer than the term. As well, if we install something that's going to die in 2 years, you may have to pay for it. So there is a built-in protection for the state from that.
And that's done by guarantees and just different maintenance type guarantees, those kind of things.
Say that again, sorry.
The guarantees for the equipment lasting for that length of period.
That is based on typical ASHRAE, the American Society of Heating, refrigeration, air conditioning, they have standard life cycles for standard pieces of equipment. There's industry standards that kind of take into account that.
Like a furnace is going to be 20 years, a boiler is going to be 25 years, a chiller might be 15 years.
Might be 70, 20 now, 15 or 20.
Typically.
Typically.
And if it goes out sooner, then you guys...
So we are, that would affect the energy guarantee, not if the warranty of the equipment itself, not so much the legality of the initial contract.
Say that one more time.
Got it.
It would affect the contract itself from a guarantee standpoint and the guarantee of the equipment, the mechanical equipment. Every piece of equipment typically comes with a 5, 10, whatever the warranty is, but it wouldn't affect the same statute legislative requirement.
Damn, we're the state. Okay.
This is just an illustration of it. Obviously, some of the annual guarantee savings is the self-funded project. I'm going to pass this to Michael and talk generally with how a project is built. This is where people get uncomfortable because, like, okay, you're going to come in, this is the scope of the project, what are you guys going to build?
Mm-hmm.
We don't know yet until we are deep in the facility. We have some ideas because Kurt Pickett's on a little previous tour, but until we get super deep in the weeds, this is an exploratory event that's super collaborative with the team here. And we slowly kind of iterate and refine this down to something that makes sense for you guys.
Okay. Michael.
Hey, before you can we get a copy of that?
For sure. Yeah, I'll send it to you again.
Hey, thank you.
Yes, sir.
So what we do when we start is we rely on Kurt to show us his worst boiler room, his grungiest air handler, the places where he knows that there are old equipment, failing equipment, things that haven't been updated or refreshed in a long time. We're not exactly
sure. Has he walked you through this already?
Yeah,
we've seen a lot of it.
Okay.
And told us not to breathe too hard on the one pool structure that.
Don't.
It's good advice.
He was worried that. Yeah.
That was sound advice.
But
unless you can come up with a solution for it.
We're not exactly sure what we'll find, but we know that we'll find a mix of really quick payback elements and longer-term capital projects that you haven't got the budget for, but you know you need to have. So, like, we'll go and look at the building control system and say, oh, these air handlers are bringing in more outdoor air than you need based on ventilation codes. can we reduce the amount of outflow repair? And that's energy savings that can be done at the, you know, adjusting a couple of controls in your main automation system. Then maybe take this to your boiler room and says, these boilers are not piped in a way that allows redundancy between the boilers. So if I lose this boiler, that pool goes down. And we retype this manifold so that we have this boiler could serve all three pools so that I have redundancy. That might not generate a lot of energy savings, but it's operational, it's capital projects that you wanted to do. And so if we have a list of the priorities of those projects that aren't going to finance themselves on energy, we can use the projects that have a really good payback to kind of levelize a project as a whole, with some that are really energy winners, some that are energy losers, but contribute to your facility having redundancy and addressing that for maintenance. So that we could come in and make a list of 20 or 30 potential measures. We can narrow that down with the facility staff to the ones they're most interested in. Maybe they tell us that there's a really legitimate reason that they can't do that, and we throw it out. That happens all the time. It doesn't hurt our feelings. But there will always be a big list. We'll narrow it down, focus on the ones that are most important, that can be supported by energy savings from the easier or more cost-effective ones, and then develop it towards a point where we can both have firm construction costs and guarantee energy savings to make a project to self-finance. Kind of like what I'm saying, building on making control systems, upgrade or change control set points. Do the same for lighting. Here where you have ice rinks that is constantly rejecting heat, pool that constantly demand heat, share loops. You know, that's politically complicated, but technically possible. We've seen it done. You guys have
water RTU
rooftop units, so like a packaged box with a furnace and a cooling coil on the roof, different from your chiller and your boiler that have hot water ports. You can do domestic hot water, you can use irrigation controls, building weatherization, you can do air sealing and sealing up cracks and gaps between windows and doors and around building foundations. We do a lot of design and installation of solar, so photovoltaic systems on the roof or even solar thermal hot water systems. And we can evaluate anything that saves money outside of energy, so we have utility rate switch or hydrogen rate switch. And that's what lets us do large pieces of equipment. So we pay for that level of energy, but do we need to slow it?
We are going under construction with a project down in Moab, the city, and the city had one 600 grand piece of equipment that was just more on their side that was broken forever and they couldn't get funding for it. And they said, help me pay for that. So basically, Michael and the team went down and identified that every single thing under the sun that we could do, small VHU replacements, control strategies, building weatherization, all with the goal of we need to get enough energy and OPEX savings out of this project to offset the fact with the boat anchor that that piece of equipment is, and they were able to do it. So it's strategies like that to help tackle these highly cost-intensive pieces of equipment that you have to replace a lot of these loading groups. And this is just kind of an illustration of the process in general. Each year, guaranteed savings, you couple this into a 10 to 20 year agreement. That's equipment that is installed and the energy cost savings guarantee that you provide is the lateral for the bank. We funnel that and work with your guys' financial advisor or whoever preference you have. We have suggestions there to form.
But are the banks picky on the collateral? I mean, they don't want a diving board. And get serious.
So this is the fun part. And I'm not a financial advisor.
I understand.
What I've been told. They can collateralize an LED light bulb, but under no situation do they want to pay somebody to come in and rebuild that light bulb. That doesn't make any sense.
Or put a guiding board in the bank.
Yes.
Their bankers have such nice houses.
They will collateralize it. It's something that the industry does.
They will only collateralize equipment that's part of what we're installing in our scope.
Correct.
So they won't come to your diving board or to your session stand.
Sure.
But like solar panels or RTUs, could be part of the collateral. Obviously, like Jason said, I've never heard of a situation where they actually send a truck in repo.
Yeah.
And I'm going to stop asking questions. We're out of time. But I do have one more question.
Yeah, please.
Can you get a copy of the paperwork we have to sign to Kevin?
You already have that, right? Cool. So I think you guys have that. And yeah, this is, I think it's on the last slide. All that is what Bernie said. A couple of other mandatory examples. We've worked a lot with the mandatories in the city OF, down in St. George. Fairfield City was a really cool project. So we've had a lot of mandatory experience. These are often the most fun environments you work in. You only work in so many elementary schools before you start to load and pretty dead. So these are really complex problems or stuff that we have.
While you're standing here, yeah. Kevin or Kirk, any questions, comments, thoughts?
So he is in touch, well, unless I missed it, on the auditing account.
Yes.
So maybe explain that is one of the pieces before
everything else comes for this.
So and that there's not, once the audit's done, if it doesn't make sense,
yep.
Then
do there's that.
Do that.
And it's not an investment-grade audit. So this contractor's process is in two parts. What Kevin has already is the investment-grade audit contract. This is essentially the design, development, and iteration process. So this is, I think it was from my head written down, 28,000. There's a state number that we have on our contract. We charge by square footage. The full transparency is we lose money on it because it's put a lot more effort into it than we make. It's just kind of the design standard fee. So that process has four key points. It's the kickoff meeting where we do all this deep dive with Kurt and the team, get the guts of the building, start collecting all the data. We do a full utility analysis where you get a lot of fancy charts and graphs, but basically they help us identify the bad actors and where the opportunity lies. We nerd out hard back in our office with whiteboards that are everywhere. You should come see it sometime. And come together a month or so after the fact to have what we call a 30% meeting. This is the first.
How about 31?
30%. So 30, 60, 90%. And this is a sit down with the district on everything that we thought of, really solid ideas, wild and crazy ideas. What do you think about this idea? And we start to narrow down feasibility of each of those into stuff that you guys like, stuff that you hate and wouldn't work, and stuff that you want to see more information with. So once we have that directive from that meeting, we come back, we start doing more detailed design on what we've identified in our scope, come back for 60% and do that same thing again. Hey, we got more information. This actually isn't going to save you that money, or hey, this is going to be way too expensive. We can't do it. And we come to this really solid package that we mutually agree upon that this is a really solid project. It meets our financial targets. We're going to develop it more. That final stage is when we put the guarantees to it. We go to final engineering design. We do our final energy calculations. We get final guaranteed costing for you guys. So you have a guaranteed cost of construction. You have a guaranteed energy savings annually. And package all that up for you guys next week with us. What Kevin was referring to is we have a clause within that contract basically saying that at the end of that process, you guys do not believe that there exists a project that meets your financial needs, or you're not exactly entirely sure of that this is what meets the targets that we set out at the beginning of the kickoff. You guys don't owe us anything. So that's when we mutually part ways, shake hands, and say see you later. It rarely happens because, like Michael says, there's always a project there that is financially attractive, but it is a legitimate off-ramp for you guys if you, at that point, don't see it in the financial
metrics. Okay. So the investment grade audit contract for you is to take us through this process of designing a project, getting to a guaranteed construction cost and guaranteed savings. At that point, there will be a decision about whether to construction needs to be the $1 to $3 million project based on stuff we've got, or to pause down in your $28,000 report and see what your energy use of this building is, attractive energy efficiency.
What is your general timeline on phase one from 30, 60, 90? Is that a months-long process?
Yeah. Well, there's an engineer answer. It's always no or it depends, right?
Sure.
As far as it depends. it depends on the size of the building and the complexity.
Sure. 6 months, a year, 9 months.
Not a year.
2 months to get to a 30%. Probably another 2 months to get to a 60%. Probably another 2 months to get to a 90%. So probably 6 months.
Yeah, typically about 60% is when we hope you guys start feeling comfortable. That's a really good time to start engaging a financial advisor, scoping out these financial pictures and making some good decisions.
Okay.
So it's
Thank
not
you.
Like you don't see us for 6 months. It's a very
I get it. Yeah. Okay.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
No, I think good. Great presentation.
Very good information. Thank you very much. And yeah, if you can make sure that Kevin has that and then he can send it to the board, that would be great. And again, we'll just funnel any of the questions and things like that we have through Kurt and Kevin and things like that. But thank you for taking your time and being here and things like that. And feel free to stick around and have some pizza in just a few minutes here. I am going to call the working meeting closed at 5:36. If you want some pizza, let's take about 3 minute break and then we'll jump right into the board regular board meeting. But please, there's water, there's pizza, restrooms are down in the hall.